damage to the wing. So it doesn't surprise me. Now, when you heard that report that NASA is likely to extend the amount of time we're going to be using this the space shuttle, where did you hear that or where did you read that, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW?
First of all, it's not coming out of NASA. It's coming out of Congress, doing their budget thing. Because they don't really want to spend the money going to the moon. But it's actually been on a bunch of news reports, and I think it was in the New York Times also. I don't know if you're aware of it, but actually next month, or I think it's about 3 weeks, the Japanese are going to be sending their ferry up there, which is a robotic, remote control vehicle, which carries, I think, 6 or 7 tons of stuff. And by the way, we no longer have 3 up there, although there's 3 Americans, but there's 3 others. Although, within the next couple of hours, if you listen to my repeaters, there'll be like just 12. There'll be 12 folks on the station. But, so there's a little bit of redundancy that they don't have to rely on the Russians completely in terms of ferrying stuff up there. But the concept coming out of Congress, this is not out of NASA, is to extend the shuttle and slowly work on the Ares rocket, get that thing ready. And then after that, then they can go and do the Orion and all that stuff.
Fantastic. So if that comes from Congress, ordinarily, NASA would have to make a proposal like that sheepishly, hoping that they would get the funding from Congress. And now it's a congressional decision. Fantastic. That means it's really going to happen, as I see it. Those guys know how to put their money where their mouth is, so to speak. They're going to pay for it. You and I are going to pay for it. And they're going to authorize it. Well done. Okay. There was another question I was going to ask you, but I've forgotten it, Eric. Oh, yes. You did say that they're going to be meeting up very soon. In other words, I know there's been a number of delays of the most recent shuttle launch. I think you're telling me it did take place. Maybe it took place today, and sometime in the next couple of days, a link up with the shuttle will take place, with the space station. Back to you for further information on that, Eric.
Yeah, no, they launched just last night, was it? It was either last night or the night before, I forget, because they're just about to, usually takes them a day. I think it was the night before. No, I'm not sure. It was either last night or the night before. Let's see. I don't know. Today's Sunday, right? No, it went up on Saturday. I'm not sure which day, but I looked at the monitor before I left the house, because I'm actually, the IRLP is down. I'm just about to take care of that, so the folks around the country that normally listen to us are not hearing us at the moment, but they will in a few minutes. Go to the NASA website. I think it was yesterday. It was either yesterday or the day before, but when I left the house, the shuttle was approaching the station.
Beautiful. Okay, so they did make that launch finally. And so I think you're saying there were 6 astronauts and cosmonauts on board of the shuttle. Not on the International Space Station. And looks like you're going to be giving us a space report tonight, Paul. This particular mission, obviously they're bringing up supplies, and I think there's another module being brought up on this particular mission. Is that true, Eric? Go ahead.
I'm not certain of the answer, and I've got to check into this place, so I'll be back in a minute.
Okay, take your time. Let's see now. Is there anyone else that wants to bring information and or questions to our attention? Speak up right now. If not, there's something I want to tell you that's, in my opinion, very troubling. And I'm going to be asking for your help to try to solve a particular problem that exists on Long Island. So let's see, is anyone else with further questions or comments? Give me a call that is right now.
Hold away for a while, Dick, because I know you were discussing something very interesting, which I know heck of a lot about, the famous WOW signal, being I was there, and know the place quite well, so I didn't get a chance to put in my 2 cents about it, Dick, over.
Okay, we had a double with Mel. Mel's going to tell us more about the WOW signal, and there was another station on top of Mel. Who was the other station?
This is WA2VDH, John, just with a comment.
Okay, sounds like you've got a brief comment. Go right ahead, John.
The comment was, I remember reading in, I think it was QST or QEX several months ago, about the Arecibo dish. They did some calculations and found that it is capable of communicating with an identical machine out to a distance of 10,000 light years. And I just found that that was a fascinating thought. Go ahead.
It sure is, John. Since the nearest other star, Alpha Centauri, is 4 light years away, and so our Arecibo dish, the 1,000-foot diameter dish in Arecibo, Puerto Rico, could communicate with a similarly equipped dish 10,000 light years away. The next question is, how many stars are in that particular radius? And the answer is a huge number. So we are now beyond the point where there's a lot of societies we can talk to. Now, I say talk to, listen to. The conversation, unfortunately, at the speed of light is going to be kind of slow. It takes you 3.5 hours to get a signal out to Pluto at the speed of light, where the Pioneer 10 and 11 spacecraft is right now. It takes you 11 hours at the speed of light to send a signal telling it to turn on a transmitter and call home. Then you wait another 11 hours to get the signal coming back. So the speed of light, as fast as it is, the fastest thing we know about, is kind of slow. So 10,000 light years away, if you talk to a society at that distance, it'd wait 20,000 years to get an answer if they answered immediately. So two-way communication by radio is not so likely. But to hear their broadcast, to hear their beacons, to hear the results of their particular civilization would create a lot of excitement. I mean, from my point of view, in technical circles, there was quite a bit of quiet excitement on the subject of making the first real confirmation of the presence of a planet going around some other star outside of our solar system. And now we've got 260 or so of those discoveries already made. Now we're starting to look for the planets that are not just how many and where, but how many of them are in the Goldilocks zone. Definition of the Goldilocks zone is you're at the right distance from that particular star where water in liquid form is likely to be, because life as we know it is definitely helped by liquid water. It's not absolutely mandatory. You dig down into the ice of Antarctica and you will find biological life living there. It's not thriving real rapidly and It's not propagating real rapidly, but life, it's extremely difficult to go anywhere in the deepest ocean, the highest mountain, the driest desert, the hottest desert, the coldest place. It's extremely difficult to go to any place on planet Earth without finding life there if you know how to look for it. The only place to date is the Atacama Desert on top of the Andes Mountains in Chile, where they get a tenth of an inch of rain per decade. That particular location is so darn dry that you scoop up some of that soil, put it in your petri dish, and wait, and nothing happens. That's the only place I know of on planet Earth, a tiny little chunk of land at the top of that mountain, where they are setting up some optical telescopes by the European Southern Observatory. And a buddy of mine works there. That's the only place where life has not been discovered. It's very rugged if you know how to look for it. So we believe life will progress most rapidly if you've got liquid water. But it's not the only way. Also, when it comes to hydrocarbon life, we believe is the most likely, because the carbon molecule is extremely good at finding all kinds of forming all kinds of fancy bonds that allow you to make biological organisms. Anybody have any further questions or comments on this one? Well, let's go over to Mel right now. Mel, tell us what you know about the WOW signal. And this book that I was reading gives quite a bit of information, but you also were right there in Miamisburg, Ohio, and I bet you also walked across the surface of that dish, so to speak, like I did way back in the early 70s. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. Yeah, many a time I've walked there, looked at the thing, touched it, you name it. And the size of it was quite immense. Give you an idea, the antenna range that it was set up on was a little larger than actually, it was bigger than 3 football fields. And according to Mr. J.K., the radio sources were able to receive at a distance at least 10 billion light years. So it was it was a nice setup there, quite a bit of equipment. And basically I used to talk, of course, to the people that ran the operation there. And I had it instantaneous. It was a 50-channel system, basically. And IF filters were 10.7, and individual filter bandwidth, I think, was around 10 kilohertz. And it used a, what the heck did it use? It was a type of, a computer synthesizer. I remember it was a 50-channel unit there, Dick. I looked at it. It was called actually, it was a chart recorder, because I did make a copy of the WOW chart. I have the WOW chart hanging here. And the WOW, let me let it drop. I'll tell you exactly when the WOW took place. Okay, the WOW took place actually August 15th, 1977, 22 hours, 15 minutes, 35 seconds Eastern Standard Time. The signal lasted approximately 1 minute and never did reappear. The scientists at the time said the signal was intelligent of origin and had to be from deep space, most likely somewhere at least past Mars or something. So how this happened, again, I don't know, but I'm looking at this thing and I can see it was intelligent. I'm just looking at the WOW printout I have here of the original WOW sheet they had. I said, run me off a copy. So they're very nice to give me a copy of it, Dick. Over.
KC2NJY. KC2NJY. Start up for your name, sir, and then your question or comment.
Yes, hello. This is Eric from Larkspur, New York. I'm actually new to this tech net. At an appropriate point, I won't ask it now, but at an appropriate point when I'm directed to, I do have a basic question regarding physics and electricity and power. It has to do with basic concepts of physics and power, but not directly with radio. So at an appropriate time, I'm going to ask the question to the participant.
Very fine, Eric. Mel, I'm going to go away from my rig for about 30 seconds. Go ahead and talk about the WOW signal. I want to go get the book, and I want to compare my copy of WOW to your copy of WOW. Be right back, Eric. Go ahead, Eric. Mel, K2KEY to take over for the next half minute or so. K2LIW.
Okay, very good. Basically, where they were looking, the search area is located somewhere between 1.4 and 1.7 gigahertz. This part of the spectrum is actually known as the water hole. It will exhibit a noise temperature somewhere, I think, between 6 to 8 degrees Kelvin. And that means that possibly they thought that if a 1 gigawatt EIRP transmitter that would be located, say, 26 light years away would be able to be heard on this system of SETI. This is basically what we were looking for at the time. Now, what else can I say about the, basically the system that we use, were using at the time, which was the popular system for the SETI project, was called Very Long Baseline Interferometry. VLBI is actually referred to. And maybe you want to make some comments if you're back on that, Dick. Over.
Yes, the extremely long, very long baseline interferometry is a technique of setting up multiple radio telescopes displaced in various places in the world. The width of your telescope at your particular operating frequency represents some number of wavelengths of width of that antenna. Take the number of wavelengths of the width of the antenna, divide it into the number of 70 degrees. That tells you how many degrees of beam width your antenna has. So you can set up a telescope bigger and bigger if you own enough land. The next step beyond that is to use one radio telescope in Hawaii, one in California, one in Maryland, and connect them together. Now, the word connect them together doesn't mean you run a transmission line between each one of those across the ocean, so to speak. You run a very accurate recorder with very accurate timing signals connected to it, like you're both listening to the National Bureau of Standards, and that's a timing path, a timing track on your particular recorder. So you make a recording in Hawaii, you make a recording in California, you make a recording in Maryland, and you bring all of those recordings to one particular place and you process them. And so you play back that signal, and now because the distance between Hawaii and Maryland is X number of miles, you've got an extreme increase in the angular resolution of your radio telescope. That's what very long baseline interferometry. By interferometry, I mean as the Earth rotates, because the Earth rotates from west toward east, in other words, at some period of time, the United States, the New York City will be located where London was, you know, some number of hours later, so to speak. That's the way the Earth rotates. So because of Earth rotation, the Hawaii station is getting closer to the extraterrestrial source, and the Maryland station is getting further away. So there's a deterministic, there is a predictable way in which the phase shift of those signals takes place, and that's what really determines the antenna pattern. So you get this huge increase in resolution, the fineness of the picture, when you use very long baseline interferometry. And in that particular example I gave you, because those stations are displaced, let me drop, in an east-west manner, you get much sharper beamwidth in the east-west manner. By also using simultaneously other radio telescopes that are displaced in a north-south manner, you can get increased resolution in that direction. So this becomes what's called a synthesized array, a partially filled array. And the fact that there's a whole lot of land in between means that doesn't contain any radio telescope, means you have a little bit less sensitivity than you would have if you had filled up all that space in between, but you still have the angular resolution. And if each of those radio telescopes is big enough to give you the sensitivity you desire, it's a very good combination. So I think that's part of what you're discussing. Now, the actual signal itself that was on that hard drive that got printed out as a paper hard copy of the so-called WOW signal is listed as 6 Echo Quebec Uniform Juliet 5. I'll replace that. 6 Echo Quebec Uniform Juliet 5. And once you know that the amplitude recorded during each 15 second of time approximately is, or maybe that's every 10 seconds of time, but each amplitude first goes through the numbers, then climbs through the alphabet, and then back down again. I actually made a plot of that display, and it's a beautiful Gaussian-shaped curve that exactly follows the beamwidth of that particular radio telescope. I wonder if your WOW signal shows something similar, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Exactly. 6 Echo Queen United Juliet 5. That's exactly. There was also a sidebar that they mentioned here. There was something also that was unusual. There was a repeat, repeat of the number 6 on the next line. And the other, you know, the other, because actually, you see, it's hard to explain, but because you'd have to look at a picture of how the antenna was set up, but it actually is two halves. So, actually, you could say like one half of the antenna did pick up this information, and then it began to repeat itself in the second antenna, but only started with 6, and then they said a little further down that there was a 5 that was repeated, Dick, over.
Yeah, the way that radio telescope worked is that there were two feed horns side by side. When you walked across that sheet of aluminum that was bigger than a football field, which was in between the parabolic reflector, which was at the south end of the radio telescope, and the great big rectangular tiltable reflector, the flat reflector at the north end of the telescope, in between the two were these two side-by-side feed horns displaced in an east-west manner. And so in order to get confirmation of a signal, as the Earth rotates and as you sweep that antenna pattern across a source, the focused beam first goes across the first feed horn and gives you a Gaussian-shaped pattern. Then some number of minutes later, depending on how far those two horns are displaced in an east-west manner, the signal then waves across the second horn. And so by getting a repetition of the pattern that when you're sweeping across, let's say, a noisy star, the fact that you get the exact same pattern again is confirmation, and you can integrate the two together. You can do what's called a spectral overlay. You can take each of those integrated patterns, lay them on top of each other, because you know exactly how much they are displaced in time, and you end up with a higher resolution, better signal-to-noise ratio, and that's part of the way the radio telescope worked. So the first wow signal was the 6EQ Uniform Juliet 5, and then the that exact same signal from space started waving across the second feed horn. You got the first six of the beginning of the second pattern, which should have been identical to the first, and then if I understand correctly, the signal abruptly discontinued. This particular article, and I'm reading this book by Michael Brooks, B-R-O-O-K-S. It's a beautiful paperback book, which only cost $15 or something like that. I got it from I guess it was Amazon.com. The title of the book is 13 Things That Don't Make Sense. And one of those 13 things is the so-called wow signal received by the Ohio University Radio Telescope. Now back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. Yes, that's what I'm saying. What happened was, I could tell you, the other half, they started, they got the six, and then there was a blank, 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 and then a five did show up, because according to the chart here, a five did show up. Further on, it started, another signal sequence was started with a seven, but nothing happened, so they just you know, just really disregarded that. But the actual, let me remember how that system was set up. It was very interesting how the system was set up there. Gee, I used to walk through that. I was in that room. In fact, I knew the guy, the ham, that he was operating the system. But they had two horns, like you say. They were 1,400 to 1,750 megahertz at the time, I remember. Then there was the two Sage gas set preamps, the switcher. And then went through what is known as the IF amplifiers, power splitting system, the IF amplifier. And then they had what is known as the square, used to use that, known as the square lore detector system, which set a phase detector, actually it was two phase detectors, and then went to the chart recorder. I mean, that was the basic system that went in. The
IRLP, node enabled.
The bandpads still for looking, I think they were 150 megahertz. Let me remember what the oscillator is. The first oscillator, I remember, was 1390 megahertz. I'm trying to remember some of the things about it. But let me drop for a second. I'll make one more comment about the VL, the very long base interferometry system. The whole system that they could say was the multi-antenna system was basically, you know, dependent on what they were, when the atomic clocks came online, made it possible, because this way you were able to synchronize the separate local oscillators at all the different locations to you know, what really, to a fraction of a second. That's what really what made it possible to be able to have these systems, you know, separated by long distances and still be effective, Dick. Over.
According to this particular article in the book that I'm reading, it said the signal occurred at August 15th, 1977, at 11:16 p.m. Eastern Daylight Saving Time. There was supposed to be a 3-minute delay between those two feed horns, and that blank that you're discussing, where you saw the 6 and a whole bunch of blanks and then a 5, I wonder if there was just some kind of a failure in the recording system, because it was being recorded on a hard disk over and over again. There could have been a blank spot on that particular hard disk, and they were wiping clean, doing a printout, and then starting the recording process again. It was Jerry Ehrman's house, E-H-M-A-N, is the man who first saw the signal that was dropped off by the technician as a bunch of paper printout where he wrote down the word wow. And it's very sad that radio telescope got sold out from under John Krause, and they didn't get a chance to use it some more. When you were actually at the operating position of the radio telescope, it was really below ground in a cool laboratory hall, so to speak, underneath the telescope. That sounds like where you went quite frequently during your free time while you're at Ohio University. Is that true, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, Dick.
Yeah.
Can we take a pause here for a minute so I can just do something real fast?
Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
Thank you.
ID Auto Connect enabled. Welcome to the New England Reflector, 912. Channel.
Go ahead, continue.
Okay, you probably know that all of those touch tones were being repeated, and sometimes I think you don't want those coming out over the air. So, was it below grade that you were actually visiting the operating position of that radio telescope, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
It was a building that was, if you looked at the antenna system, it was to the left of the antenna system. It was called the blockhouse. And basically, that's where all the equipment was located. And it was fascinating, a very fascinating, you know, operation there. And I can say John Krause basically did all the work there and really operated, you know, did the operation and the layout of it. You mentioned the fellow that used to visit there quite often was that guy Grote Reber, W9GF Zetterham, that actually was the amateur astronomer, built the first one of the parabolic radio telescopes. Based on a lot of the work that I know they had a picture up there, it was sort of like the hero, is this guy Carl Jansky, a telephone radio engineer that performed, you know, first of the, communications at the long wave, at the wavelength of, what was it, like 14 meters or something. And he studied at that time, the extraterrestrial radiation to be received. So I remember seeing those pictures there of Jansky and Reber. They were like very prominent in the system, in the development of this system, Dick. Over.
Fantastic. As you look at the history of radio astronomy, the very first radio astronomy measurement officially made by mankind was done by Carl Jansky, 1932, at Bell Labs. Bell Labs was complaining about the fact that their overseas radio circuits were seeing excess noise once in a while, and they wanted to know where it's coming from. So Carl set up this Sturber curtain-like rotatable antenna. I've actually seen the antenna, put my hands on it, and rotated it. That also is located right out front of the entrance area at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Green Bank, West Virginia. So Jansky's antenna and Grote Reber's antenna are both there on the front lawn, so to speak. This antenna rotated on automobile wheels, four automobile wheels as I remember, and the antenna was in the vicinity of 20 feet wide, a Sturber curtain operating at something in the vicinity of 20 megacycles. And so what he did was to take this aimable antenna, measure the radio noise he was getting. He found a certain direction where he was getting a maximum radio noise. He was smart enough to do the measurement day after day, and he realized that the signal was changing in direction by approximately 1 degree per day. He recognized the fact that as the Earth goes around the Sun, the exact same position you aim as far as an Earth-bound observer is a different place in space each day as the Earth goes around the Sun. He soon realized that the signal was drifting in right ascension at the exact same rate that the Sun goes, that the Earth goes around the Sun. He soon realized it was extraterrestrial. And it turns out what he was measuring was the center of our galaxy, but he didn't know that. He recognized that it was an extraterrestrial source at some fixed point in our particular galaxy. He recognized that, reported that, and dropped the project. Well, he had no further funding, and he didn't seem to be that much interested in it. That occurred in 1932. He recognized the source. He found out it was extraterrestrial. It wasn't something mankind had control over, and he went no further with it. And a few years later, Groh Greeber, in Wheaton, Illinois, is where I think he lived, he decided to build a radio telescope in his backyard.
Repeater, time out.
Hey, Angel, while I watch, checking up on the internet.
And he didn't, okay, Joe, he didn't do it by way of a rotatable antenna that only could rotate in azimuth. He built a fully steerable dish that could be rotated in azimuth and elevation. And it was made out of these steel plates and this wooden support structure, this parabolic reflector. And if you read his story, which is also reported in a particular issue of the IEEE Proceedings, where the whole issue is a special issue devoted to radio astronomy, there's a very nice story by Groh Greeber as to all the measurements he made. He eventually went to higher and higher frequencies where he thought he was going to get better and better signals. Well, because he was using acorn tubes and had, by modern-day standards, an extremely high noise figure receiver, as he went higher in frequency, he didn't see more signal like he expected. He saw less signal because of the noise figure of his receiver, I believe, was a major contributing factor. Back to you, Mel, for any further comments on all of this. K2KEY, K2RIW.
There's quite a bit to it. This is K2KEY, that what transpired. I remember when I visited the Acerebo setup, because at the time I was able to get into that carriage. That was an experience, Dick, to really say, because this guy, Bob Zimmerman, at the time, who I went to school with, was the operator at the time, and they had, I remember looking at that 18-centimeter receiver that I think you know a little bit about. And the SETI project was set up at the time. I remember meeting him by a fellow by the name of Professor Paul Horowitz. He was frequently there back in the 70s, and what the heck was this called? I think it was HFA. And he was basically did become the prime director of the Acerebo system in the 70s, late 70s, in the work on the SETI project, Dick, over.
Now, you actually went to Puerto Rico to the 1,000-foot diameter dish. How do they pronounce the name of that town? I've heard it very frequently pronounced Arecibo, but do the people in Puerto Rico pronounce it the other way that you're pronouncing it right now? Back to you, Mel.
Yes, when I say they refer to it as Arecibo, because it's Spanish, the Spanish accent on it, Arecibo. So that's the way they pronounce it. Yeah, this thing is, you got to stand there and look at it, behold. First of all, you feel dwarfed by it. How can I really, tell you what it looks like? It's a 1,000-foot dish, and basically that's what it is. And the carriage assembly is 425, 430 feet above And the inside the dome, they kept the temperature around, I think it was around 80 degrees Kelvin, with liquid nitrogen to reduce the noise temperature of the front end at the time. I remember looking at that. That was something to behold, how they did that, Dick. And it's, like I say, it was just mind-boggling, over.
Yeah, if anybody's ever seen the picture of this particular 1,000-foot diameter radio telescope in Arecibo, or Arecibo, depending on how you pronounce it, the feed horn is in the center of a spherical dish. It's not parabolic. It's a spherical dish. And by moving the feed horn left and right, you steer the dish plus or minus something like 15 degrees from zenith, from straight up in Puerto Rico where this is located. The feed horn is something like 400 feet above that spherical reflecting surface. And they've got this carriage that will bring you out to the feed horn, which is suspended 400 feet in the air above the dish by these huge cables that go out to these three pylons out at the perimeter of the dish. If life depends on those cables, that whole feed horn assembly and you are held in the air by that. And a great big waveguide assembly goes from there out to the actual, the rest of the electronics. And so liquid nitrogen, I think, is being used to cool the low noise front end. Liquid nitrogen boils off at 77 degrees Kelvin, and so by the liquid nitrogen use, I guess they're able to keep their cryogenically cooled low-noise front end at something like 80 Kelvins, as they call it, 80 degrees above absolute zero, where you therefore get a much lower noise figure and a much higher sensitivity of the receiver. What in the world brought you down to Puerto Rico, Mel? How did you wrangle that particular one? Did you go there as a contractor, as a visitor on vacation? Your good buddies had a some kind of a way of getting into the place. How in the world did you arrange that, Mel? K2KEY, and how long were you there? K2RIW?
Comment. Okay, just to comment 1 minute. Well, went on vacation, and I used to talk to Bob quite often. Bob was... He had a call. I think he had a call down in Puerto Rico at the time. He did get a ham license down there. And he says, if you ever come down here, he says, look me up. Don't forget, Mel. I want to see you. I haven't seen you in a few years. You know, we were good pals for a while there. And when I got there, I gave him a call. He was so surprised. He says, I'll tell you what. You come here on so-and-so, so-and-so time. And I need I'm going to do some work or something on there. He said, so I need an assistant. You're my assistant. You carry the tool bag. And where did we go? Cut on to the carriage. Dick, he was one of against it. I thought for sure, well, this is the end. But once you get in the carriage, it's something. But if you went to the receiver room, that was something to behold. That is the first time I ever looked at this contraption called the Rubidium Standard. And you should have seen this box. It was impressive. I says, what in the heck had it got in this box that the way it's built and locked up? And he says, it's called the Rubidium Standard. That the standard for, gets all the measurements, Dick, over.
There, I think I got you on that one, Mel. Most people pronounce it rubidium. Most people pronounce it rubidium. You got to put the emphasis on the right syllable. Well done. I hope you took a lot of pictures while you're on that carriage. Who is the person who said comment? Give us your call letter's name and go ahead with your question or comment, sir.
Yes, this is WW2W.
Okay, Mr. Triple Double U, go right ahead. What's your name, sir?
Oh, I'm sorry, it's Tony, yeah. Both of you guys, you gentlemen have met me before. Yeah, I've seen pictures and movies of this thing before, but now I'm looking at the details of the Arecibo dish. And yes, it is quite impressive. I see how the focal point thing works. It looks like some sort of Coney Island ride. And it probably is higher than the parachute of Coney Island to where it focuses. I see also they have some sort of arrangement on the edge to break up the diffraction that occurs on at most parabolic or spherical dishes. And believe it or not, they even have on Twitter, it says Arecibo Observatory watching for asteroids and streaming live tonight. I guess if you look up Arecibo on Twitter, you could really get involved with that. It sounds like it's very exciting. Back to you.
Yeah, thank you for the information, Tony. Fascinating dish. Eric signed in KC2NJY, and go right ahead with your question, Eric. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
B2HWW, and a comment on a previous subject, Dick?
Go ahead, Howie.
I don't know, I was listening half asleep to a thing with a power supply. If you don't have a scope and you want to check for a hum, just take a loudspeaker, a little 8-ohm speaker, you know, a little 3-inch, with a, and put a capacitor in series and use that. Or if you want to get a little more sophisticated, just put a capacitor in series with an audio amplifier. Go ahead, Dick.
Not a bad idea, but he wasn't troubleshooting hum. That was Steve. He was Stephen. He was troubleshooting a complete failure where it was blowing fuses. So he wasn't at the stage yet of analyzing any hum of his regulated power supply. Mel, back to you. Did you take pictures while you were on that carriage, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
Negative. Wouldn't let me take any pictures. No pictures were permitted at the time. The only pictures they had were some pictures that were released for publicity. I don't know why, but you were not, no cameras were permitted. In fact, I wasn't really supposed to be there, to say the least, Dick, that he convinced them, the person that was supposedly, you know, signed us in, that I was specifically, you know, brought in to technically advise on some information that has to be fed into or adjusted into something. Yeah, I don't know what really we were supposed to do. I think it was just, you know, a good story so I could get to take a ride in the thing, and he could fool around with the... He was having a good old time with that piece of equipment that he was playing around with. Dick, you know, it's... for the couple of guys that were operating at the time, I think it became really a wonderfully big toy, like, for this guy Paul and this other guy, Bob and all. It looked like to me like it was for a while there working on this, you know, SETI project. It was really, they had, would you believe at the time, they had clearance for about 500 hours per year to look for the, to run it as in the SETI project, Dick, over.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way of using that telescope, that radio telescope. So it would make a very nice SETI searching piece of hardware. The only slight disadvantage of that telescope is it looks straight up in the air, and by moving the feed horn, you can move it something like plus or minus 15 degrees from straight up, which means it can track a particular source. Since the Earth rotates at 15 degrees per hour, you can track a particular source if it goes right through the middle of the antenna, so to speak, for a little bit less than 1 hour. Correction, 2 hours. A little bit less than 2 hours. But still, that's a valuable instrument. And the one that's now the very large telescope at Green Bank, West Virginia, is 300 feet in diameter. That's a little bit smaller. However, it operates not just at frequencies like 14 gigahertz and 1400 megacycles and 10 gigahertz. I think 10 gigahertz is approximately the maximum frequency you can use on the Arecibo dish, as I pronounce it, after they resurfaced it. Whereas the 300-foot diameter dish in West Virginia can be used all the way up to 110 gigahertz. It's got a surface that's made out of a whole lot of individual servo motors where each square meter, so to speak, of the surface can be tuned up and down by all the servo motors in the corners such that you can adjust for wind load, gravity, temperature expansion, and so on. It's got this laser ranging system that ranges all of the little corner cubes at the corner of each one of the panels, something like 2,600 panels that can all be tunable. So that antenna recorrects itself, instead of it only being operational, let's say, a few thousand megacycles, it can be used to 110,000 megacycles. One hell of an antenna. So as you go higher in frequency for the same dish, if you've got enough accuracy of the surface, you get more and more resolution, and believe it or not, more and more sensitivity. The gain goes up 6 dB per octave. Every time you double the frequency, the exact same size dish gives you theoretically 6 decibels more gain, as long as the surface is accurate enough, like say an eighth of a wavelength accuracy. And that antenna can do that, the one at Green Bank. And as I said, I've seen it under construction. Beautiful piece of hardware. Okay, there's a piece of...
Repeater, time out.
There's a sad situation going on in France, which has a parallel to what's going on Long Island. I'll bring it to your attention. I'm reading the latest issue of IEEE Antennas and Propagation magazine. Happens to be the June issue, but the June issue just came out a couple of days ago. They're a little late in keeping up with their subscription. The June issue on page 152 has an article by a man who works at the University of Connecticut. Rajiv Bansal is the man's name. And the name of the article is Say Au Revoir to Cell Phones. There's this condition going on in France where there are multiple groups that call themselves, what's the name that they call themselves? It sounds like Robin Hood, anyhow. Let's call it the Robin Hood of the Roofs, I think they call themselves. Robin Detroit, I think they pronounce themselves. Robin of the Roofs. There's multiple groups in France that are demanding that cell phone towers be removed from locations that are close to schools, hospitals, and private homes. Now, what makes this kind of interesting is that France, ordinarily, is not skittish about technology. Let me drop. France is the one country that has 59, count them, 59, operating nuclear reactors that generates a high percentage of their electrical power. And they're not worried about a Chernobyl situation. However, in the appeals court in Versailles, near the city of Lyon, the judge agreed that there was no evidence of a threat, but they said that there was no guarantee that the risk did not exist. The feeling of anxiety of the inhabitants was therefore justified. And that appeals court in Versailles ordered that the cell phone tower that was put near an apartment building be removed. The people in the apartment building were complaining that they were getting a metallic taste in their mouth, they were getting a nosebleed, and they were getting other biological problems because of the RF radiation from that nearby cell phone tower. And the company, the tower owner is a company called Orange, were ordered to remove the tower, and they thought, gee, this is strange that we're going to take down a tower because these people are complaining about all these medical problems. We hadn't yet installed the antennas on the tower. It wasn't operational. Ain't that crazy? Before I go on and tell you how this relates to Long Island, anybody got any comments on this one? K2LIW on the TechNet?
You don't want to be a repeater on it.
I got a comment, K2KEY, that's apropos.
Go ahead, Mel.
They put on, I have a house about a mile and a half from here, and there's an apartment building on a corner, and I'm kind of friendly with the super there, and so we stop to talk every so often. He walks his dog down the block where I have the house, and we stop to talk about especially cats and dogs, our favorite subject. And he was telling me how many broke the lease. You know, I said, oh, you got the solar antennas up on the roof here. It's a sixth-floor apartment building. He says, do you know, he says, there so far, he says, we had to break the lease for 4 tenants that actually were able to, whether they got a lawyer or whatever, but because that solar antenna was above their head, they were able actually legally to be able to terminate their lease, Dick, over.
And what makes this so crazy, Sugarman, whatever call would you like, what makes it so crazy is the fact that what people are afraid of is vocabulary. Back in the early days of 1900, when radio was being invented and being developed, people realized that once you put a signal out of a transmitter into an antenna, it tends to spread out in all directions. A perfectly good word to describe that is it radiates. Radiation, radio frequency radiation, RF radiation, perfectly good word. Until World War II came along, and along came nuclear radiation. And all of a sudden, a high percentage of the population makes the mistake of thinking that radio radiation is like nuclear radiation. And they also think that the word microwave is the worst of all the kinds of radio radiation. Boy, microwaves, that just means cancer right off the bat. You'd be amazed how many people believe that. And it's really foolish. It's a strong misunderstanding of what's going on. There are people who want to remove cell phone towers and radio equipment from their environment because they believe it is dangerous to their health. Let me drop for a minute. And their philosophy for justifying that is that, well, we thought asbestos was safe, we found out it wasn't. We thought cigarette smoking was safe, we found out it wasn't. Yes, and therefore they're saying that, well, we think radio is safe, but we're eventually going to find out it's not safe. Not true. The reason it's not true is because when we finally investigated asbestos, we found out how much of a health hazard it is. When C. Edward Koop in the early 70s started investigating cigarette smoking, and with great difficulty, he eventually got warning signs put on the side of cigarette packs. He was our attorney general, he was our surgeon general for the United States, C. Edward Koop. And so when we started investigating, we found out cigarette smoking, even though it had been going on for hundreds of years, was not safe. In the case of radio, we've been investigating it thoroughly for 60 solid years. Throughout the world, your best measurement laboratories, your best institutions, your best research organizations have been investigating radio. It is not uninvestigated. And they've been looking over and over again for the non-thermal effect. They have found nothing but the thermal effect. The bottom line of that, it means that when a radio signal strikes your body, the only thing it does is it creates heating. And as long as that magnitude of heating is controllable, there's no deleterious effect. If you stand 10 feet away from a transmitter that's transmitting 30 watts of power, the worst that can happen to you is that you'll experience an amount of heating approximately equal to standing 10 feet away from a 30-watt light bulb. A 30-watt transmitter and a 30-watt light bulb are very similar in the maximum capability of what heating it can create to your body and whether or not it can create deleterious effects. If you think that the radio signals that are in your environment are creating that much damage, you better not turn on the light bulbs, and my goodness, you better not lay down on the beach in the summertime with a bathing suit on, because that sun is exposing you to 1,000 watts of thermal power. It's optical power, but as long as you've got the right sunscreen on, as long as you're not staring into the sun, it's relatively safe, within reason. So you have to look at the power output of these transmitters and look at them as thermal emitters. That's all they are. And even if you increase the gain of the antenna, you may talk about the
repeater. Time out.
You may talk about the effective radiated power because the antenna's got 10 dB of gain and it raises the power by 10 to 1 so that a 10-watt transmitter becomes equivalent to a 100-watt transmitter. Yes, but if you look at the way the antenna performs that trick, it spreads the power over a larger area like the parabolic dish, and therefore the watts per square centimeter, the milliwatts per square centimeter, decreases. The higher the gain the antenna when you're nearby, the safer it is. It's opposite of common sense. But there are people who will use statistical alarmism techniques, and they'll say that we think it's safe, it's not. And in the case of the village of Bayville, Long Island, where it's a really classic case going on for something like 2 years, the residents of Bayville have come to the conclusion that the antennas that are on top of the water tower near the primary school in Bayville is creating cancers. There are people in the town who have strongly concluded that that is the truth. Yes, there was a student in the school that developed a cancer, and there was a faculty member in the school that developed a cancer. And you see these physical antennas 200 feet away on top of the water tower, and that's an open and shut case as far as they're thinking. And that's much too circumstantial for about four reasons. Number one, just the fact that the nearby antennas exist and cancer existed you can't conclude that the cancer was caused by those antennas. That's extremely unlikely, is what the research is telling you. Why a person develops cancer, there's a zillion complicated reasons to do with genetics, what lifestyle you live, where you live. A number of the wells in the village of Bayville had to be closed down because they contained carcinogenic substances. How do we know that those people weren't getting a cancer either because of their genetics or because of the particular well water they were drinking? Has anyone asked the question, what part of town did those particular two people who got cancer, where were they living, and what water were they drinking? Nobody asked that question. The majority of the, a high percentage of the people in Bayville have come to the conclusion that all antennas must be removed from their town. Put them in some other town. Put them in some other place. Well, it's real easy to say, we'll put them in some other place, as if you're going to build another tower. Well, where are you going to build another tower? No matter whose land you put it on, the person's going to say, not in my backyard, and who's going to pay for it? Those antennas that are on top of that water tower are supplying law enforcement communication, fire, emergency vehicles, emergency services, and cell phone. And all of it is safe. I personally went to the town with instrumentation, made measurements. I also gave testimony before the village board of that town as to my opinion as to how reasonable it is to attempt to remove the antennas. But the residents of the town have come to the conclusion that their village officials have done something wrong by allowing the antennas to exist.
Tower solution.
Hey, how many of those people had cell phones?
Solution.
It turns out the people in the town are no longer using their cell phones. They won't turn on a cell phone if the child is in the house. They won't use their laptop computer if the child is in the house. They won't use their microwave oven. They've come to the conclusion that radio is dangerous. The people in the town are sincere people. They're trying to protect their children. That's a worthwhile goal. But they're misinformed. They're responding to an erroneous myth. My request is that some of you guys know people who live in the town. We, people who use radio day in and day out for years on end, we know something about its safety and its benefit. Everything in life has risk. Can I sit here and tell you absolutely positively there isn't the slightest possible risk of using a radio? Of course I can't. I can't make that promise about drinking clean, clear water because college students will kill themselves by attempting to drink as much.
At 8 o'clock, W.
They will kill each other by kill themselves by, you know, pledging for a particular fraternity by seeing how much water they can drink in a 20-minute period. Sometimes they die from doing it. So you can misuse everything. Nothing is perfectly safe. You have to look at the risk-benefit ratio of everything you do. My request is that if you have friends and relatives who live in Bayville, gently try to convince them that they are responding to an erroneous myth. It's not going to be easy. Go easy with them. They are sincere. They live in a moderately affluent, well-educated community. But somehow an opinion of this erroneous myth got started, and everyone believes it. Well, a high percentage of the people believe it. The residents are suing their village officials because they allowed the antennas to exist, and they want all these antennas removed. They think that they are defending themselves against their village officials. They think they're defending themselves against the county, who says the antennas will remain. They think they're defending themselves against the federal government by way of the Department of Homeland Security, who wants to put more antennas. The town does not have sufficient coverage for law enforcement as it is. There are gaps in the town where fire does not have proper communication, law enforcement does not have proper communication, and emergency services, as well as cell phones, don't completely work. More antennas have to be placed, but the residents desire those antennas to be removed. They're responding to a myth. They're responding to the emotional-sounding word called radiation. And so don't expect immediate benefit. Don't expect immediate success in your attempt to reconvince them of a higher truth. It's going to happen slowly. That's the way small communities act. If you have any understanding of human nature, you'll understand how we got into this situation. But it is dangerous to try to remove the antennas because the communication is required to save life and limb. I don't think there's any simple solution to this, but slowly we have to adjust the opinion. The United States has had, let me drop. We've had many prejudicial and erroneous opinions in the past. I am convinced that this is a very erroneous opinion, and it has to be corrected. Education is required.